This is Tax Update for Saturday, April the 22nd, 2006. Tax Update podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research to confirm facts raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and this document may be reproduced freely so long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or the podcast. Such prohibited use would include using this podcast or document as part of a CPE presentation for which a fee is charged. This week's podcast is sponsored by Limeburg Information Services, available on the web at www.limeburgservices.com. Limeburg Information Services offers email newsletters of interest to tax professionals, as well as libraries of other useful information you may find helpful in your tax practice. Again, you can visit them on the web at www.limeburgservices.com. Well, we've cleared the tax season now, and as many of you may have noticed, last Monday night, there were a number of taxpayers down at the post office mailing off their tax returns to beat a midnight deadline. Well, this week we have a couple of items came down, one a ruling and one a case, that deal with the issue from a different perspective, and that is getting documents from other entities to the taxpayer, which has an issue involving a tax matter. And we're going to take a look at documents coming to the taxpayer. In this case, in one case, we're going to look at a taxpayer who changed his address, but not voluntarily. The taxpayer was a guest of the state of New York at a correctional facility, and he claims not to have received a notice of deficiency. We'll take a look at how the court handled that matter, and surprisingly, perhaps to some, how the court decided that he actually had not received that document. Secondly, we'll take a look at the case that I think a number of us have run into if you work with qualified plans, that is of the lost employee. In this case, a plan was terminated, the employee had moved, the plan sent the notice and the check to the former address. It came back. Eventually, the plan administrator turned over the check and the 1099 to the IRS, who eventually did find the taxpayer. But the question becomes now, can the taxpayer roll that distribution over, especially when the taxpayer was faced with? At the same time the IRS found the taxpayer, they issued the CP2000 notice and were assessing tax for the year in question. So we're going to look at the question about the misdelivered information, and misdelivered information in neither case was the information misdelivered because U.S. Postal Service didn't take it to where it was addressed to. In both cases, the Postal Service got to where it needed to be. The problem occurred after the Postal Service got rid of the document. The first case we're going to look at is the case of Beauty versus Commissioner, Thomas Beauty versus Commissioner. This is a tax court memorandum decision that came down in the past week and essentially is an interesting case from the looking at how we got to the believability. The citation on this one is TC Memo 2006-66, issued April the 5th. Now, Mr. Beauty, as we noted earlier, was a guest of the state of New York in their correctional facilities. Mr. Beauty was a former, shall we say, chiropractor. We presume he's no longer practicing in prison, or at least it's a little tough to get an appointment to visit him there. But he had pled guilty to, among other things, let's see, he had four different counts. He pled guilty to filing a false instrument in the first degree, insurance fraud in the second degree, grand larceny in the second degree, and attempted grand larceny in the third degree. From the fact that he pled guilty to those four charges, it certainly appears that he might have a little trouble being considered honest and believable, shall we say, by the court. In fact, the IRS had a very real problem with that concept. The question became, a notice of deficiency was sent to Mr. Beauty. He claimed he didn't receive it. The IRS asserted that we should basically can just dismiss his testimony that didn't receive it because we do know it was sent certified mail. We do know that the certified mail was signed for by a correctional facility, and therefore we should presume he got it, and since he is a criminal and, you know, convicted and essentially has shown that he may not be the totally honest person, that we think the court should just deem that he got the notice, didn't file on time, and didn't come back and raise the questions that need to be raised in a timely manner. However, the tax court pointed out that they didn't believe it could dispose of the issue solely on the basis that Mr. Beauty was a convicted felon, and that the document in question had reached the correctional facility, a correctional facility that he arrived at after the document was delivered to that facility. The known facts about what happened were summarized by the court, and these are the items that we can independently confirm. Respondent, that is the IRS, sent the document by certified mail to the petitioner at the Gowanda Correctional Facility in Gowanda, New York. And basically sent those documents to him. Now, the respondent recorded the mailing on a U.S. Postal Service Form 3877, acceptance of registered, insured, COD, and certified mail. And a certified mail list was stated at the top, statutory notice of deficiency for years indicated and sent to the following taxpayer. The Gowanda facility received this item on January 4th, 1999. So we know where it is. It got there. It was received. There is no question that the correctional facility had the item. The catch was, though, the petitioner, in this case, Mr. Beauty, did not arrive at Gowanda until January 21st, 1999. Therefore, over 2 weeks after this notice got there. Now, the correctional facility maintained a log for mail pertaining to the inmate's legal proceedings, and Mr. Beauty had quite a few of these, as we'll discover. Now, Mr. Beauty signed that log in order to receive two items of certified mail on January 21st, 1999. That's when he arrived at the facility. The log does not state the certified mail numbers of the items he received. So we know he received two certified mail documents. We do not know what they are. Now, petitioner received various articles of certified mail from respondent, that is the IRS, while he was incarcerated at Gowanda. So these are the facts we can independently verify. Now, Mr. Beauty claimed, though, that among those items he received was not the notice of deficiency. And it turns out for Mr. Beauty, which is kind of an interesting situation, but Mr. Beauty was no stranger to courtrooms and legal proceedings. In fact, the tax court notes in a footnote reference a long, and I mean very long, list of cases which Mr. Beauty had been involved in. And it goes on and lists for a while. At the very end of this list that goes on for a number of lines, the court note that petitioner apparently vigorously asserted his rights in these cases and appealed every adverse ruling. Mr. Beauty may have been a convicted felon, but he was very good at dotting I's, crossing T's, and filing his appeals. He was very, very good at doing that, and he had lots of experience in doing it. This external evidence led the court to come to the following conclusion in this case, that he did not receive the document in question. Petitioner testified that he did not receive the notice of deficiency. That is the statement we have and the level of proof at the moment. Mr. Beauty is the person who claims he didn't receive it, and frankly, that's the evidence that we have direct on point. The court goes on to note that the IRS asks us to disregard the testimony because he has a criminal record. The court indicates it disagrees. As it noted, quote, petitioner's habit is to aggressively assert his rights in dealings with the United States government. It appears from his litigating history that he responds to notices as required to preserve his litigating rights. Respondent does not contend otherwise. The court goes on to note, we conclude the petitioner did not receive the notice of deficiency or have any other opportunity to dispute his underlying tax liability for 1989 or 1990. Note, this case points out some very interesting facts here. Now, the exact case, unlikely to be duplicated. Hopefully most of us don't have a lot of clients in the correctional facilities, and those of us that do probably would not have these clients who tend to litigate everything in sight. In fact, Mr. Beauty had noted that part of the reason why he's doing this is he can't afford external help. He's basically doesn't have the cash any longer to hire professional help, so he's doing this all on his own. So basically, we probably won't have Mr. Beauty as our client. But what it does indicate is the importance of a story holding together when we go to court or when we're in front of the IRS itself. What we have here is a story that holds together because the external evidence suggests that the taxpayer is telling the truth. That becomes extremely important in making everything hang together. Many of us have clients that come up and ask us about various issues. Well, how would the IRS know, or how are they going to be able to, prove I didn't do whatever? And the answer I give to clients all the time in a case like that is presume they know it, presume they'll prove it. Because reality is that when you get away from the actual, when you try to get a case of convenience or try to conveniently indicate what can't be shown, quite often the extrinsic evidence will suggest a different result than what you had. As well, when you lose your credibility, it is very, you know, the whole case begins to fall apart. The whole issue falls apart. Many, many items in tax law depend upon the credibility of the taxpayer. Mr. Beauty apparently had one huge advantage. It appears from the evidence we can find, and certainly appears because everything held together, that in fact on this matter he was telling the truth. And the court concluded as such. Now, it's important to note, if you're trying to apply this particular case to the, oh, we did, never got the notice, it seems to me highly unlikely this result would have been duplicated had Mr. Beauty not been a frequent litigant. Now, I don't know if the court was really thrilled with encouraging Mr. Beauty to file cases early and often involving matters and to bring himself into court quite often, but the fact he had done so, and the fact he had done so religiously, and the fact he had done so quite often and knew the ropes, led the court to believe it was not plausible that he would have just ignored this notice. He would have paid attention to it had he received it. Therefore, the court concluded he didn't receive it. And it's also important to note that in this case, and I believe even though the court doesn't mention it, it is important that it does not appear that Mr. Beauty conveniently arranged his affairs to be able to have deniability about receiving this document. Mr. Beauty's affairs were being arranged by the state of New York at this time, who was transferring him from one facility to another. Therefore, the circumstances involved were totally out of his control. He was not at the location on January 4th when the letter arrived. He did not get there for 2 weeks. He had to depend upon the facility holding on to and then delivering that letter to him. Therefore, it was all out of his control. And, as noted, it appears that he truly did not receive it. Therefore, these all make together important cases getting this done. Too often it's difficult to say, while you could say the court indicates here that clearly we can say we didn't receive it, too often that excuse sounds very convenient. And that's the problem you have with the plausibility of making a case like this stick. But in Mr. Beauty's case, he was able to pull victory out of the jaws of defeat, even though the IRS believed that you shouldn't be able to believe him. Now we'll go on to our second issue involving delivery of a document. This is a private letter ruling that breaks for the taxpayer, Private Letter Ruling 2006-15031. And this deals with a case I think we see quite often, an employee lost touch with the former employer. That employee had a balance in the employer's plan. Now, the IRS summarized the facts of the situation. During the calendar year in question, the company terminated the plan. During that year, a check was sent in the amount to the individual, and the accompanying Form 1099-R was sent to that individual at an address. Now, the taxpayer indicates she had not resided at that address for a number of years, and asserts she did not receive the check. It seems to make sense, since the company eventually forwarded the full amount to the Internal Revenue Service along with a copy of the 1099-R relating to the distribution. It seems likely she didn't get the check, otherwise it seems a little strange they would have forwarded the entire amount to the IRS. On or about a later date, the taxpayer and her spouse were sent a CP2000 notice related to the calendar year, which asserted they had failed to take the distribution into income. After the receipt of the CP2000 notice, the taxpayer requested from the IRS, "Well, show me the 1099R. I didn't know we had one." And the request for an extension of the 60-day rollover period then soon followed after the funds were transmitted to the taxpayer. Now, the IRS was asked by the taxpayer in this ruling request to consider whether it could extend the rollover period per the provisions of Section 402C3B, and the taxpayer claimed that the failure to waive such a requirement would be a hardship and against equity or good conscience. In this fact pattern, the IRS ultimately agreed with the taxpayer. Now, if you think about it, it certainly appears to me that there were other arguments the taxpayer could have used to have avoided going down this route. Taxpayer could argue that, in fact, having never received the document, never received the check, that, in fact, the 60-day period should have started from their date of receipt. But, quite honestly, the private letter ruling was almost certainly the easiest route to solve the problem. It certainly got rid of everything, and just by going down that route, there were no real problems, and the IRS was extremely likely to grant the ruling in these fact patterns. What's important about this ruling is not so much this ruling, but to remember that we have these rules now, and the IRS has the authority to waive a 60-day rollover period if the facts are such that it seems to make sense there should be a waiver. There have been a number of rulings on this point. You should take a look at those rulings if you have a taxpayer who has blown the 60-day period and it appears to have blown it not due to something the taxpayer can control, we have talked about this in a previous podcast, but rather blew the rollover period due to issues outside of their control. In those cases, the IRS has been relatively liberal in allowing an extension of the 60-day rollover period. We no longer have the problem we used to have where the IRS would say they had no authority to waive. The Congress gave the IRS that authority to waive the rollover period. It now can be asked for, and in the right situation, you need to be aware of that. Well, since we're now kind of at the end of tax season, I thought I'd take a little relaxation on this podcast, and we'll give you some of the issues where you can sit back, maybe relax, and take it easy and pick up some other stuff on the internet that might be of use to you or that you might want to listen to aside from the podcast that we're talking about here. And for this week, I'm adding a list of 4 internet radio stations that I listen to. For those of you who've not done internet radio, basically, we can stream relatively high-quality audio over the internet. In fact, audio of a quality that is better than you're going to find on FM stereo radio, at least if you have a good sound system coming out of your computer. Now, most of us have cheap little speakers, so the sound's not great, but we can live with it. But these stream over the internet 24 hours a day, and in many cases, commercial-free, although they are known to beg for money. That's normal. Not quite that unusual. And there are a number of different stations available. If you listen on the internet, or if you want to listen on the internet, a good place to go for the broad view of the stations is AOLShoutcast.com website that actually was established as part of the Winamp project. Winamp is an older MP3 player. It used to be very popular on the Windows platform, now much less so. But we nevertheless still have this Shoutcast site that has a number of stations. Now, these stations range from very professional stations down to some guy sitting kind of in his room, running a bunch of odd little tunes that make little sense whatsoever. So the quality of stations goes all over the board. However, I do have 4 stations I'm going to mention that come from a variety of options that I've found to be very professional and that probably have something for somebody if you're looking for them. The first one is one I mentioned before. If you grew up in Phoenix in the 60s and 70s, and if you remember KCAC and when the original KDKB came on the air in the 70s, Radio Free Phoenix may be of interest to you. And it may be of interest even if you're not here, if you like this kind of free-form rock radio structure. Caveat, every so often they play music that might not be appropriate for mixed company, shall we say. It's not a regular occurrence. It doesn't occur all the time, but they certainly don't necessarily worry about those things. They also play a number of different tunes. They will find comic, you'll find novelty songs, you'll find all kinds of odd things that will pop up on their station. They have live DJs, which is somewhat unusual, though it's becoming more normal on the internet. You can find them at www.radiofreephoenix.com. Now, if you want a station similarly kind of eclectic, but not necessarily Phoenix-related or not necessarily as apt to play something that might be inappropriate at the time, you might take a look at RadioParadise.com, www.RadioParadise.com. They have a number of streams from very high quality down to low bandwidth, so you can control how much pressure there is on your system, at RadioParadise.com. Again, very, very useful. This is more music, more rock-oriented, deep cuts, that type of stuff. The mix is very similar to Radio Free Phoenix, but more concentrated over on the rock and music side, not really anything you're going to find with comic lines or as many novelty types tunes. Now, if your interests aren't really in rock and you're going to go toward classical music, I like one public radio station from North Carolina that I thought as a CPA had the right name, and that's www.wcpe.org of the radio station of the same call letters. And I figure any radio station called WCPE as a CPA I need to be listening to. They are available, have a number of feeds available at different speeds. Again, all of these have different speed feeds that may be available to you. And if you prefer folk, bluegrass, and the like, you want that type of music, Kent, Ohio's www.folkalley.com is also useful. Now, if you are using iTunes, you may notice there is a button on your left side of your screen that says radio. You will find there an index to a number of radio stations that Apple has put together. You can use those. You can also use the radio stations that we find via shoutcasts and other routines to listen on the internet. As I say, the station qualities go from very good to very, very flaky, but they are an interesting way, and they certainly are a nice way to listen. And if you do have them hooked up through a decent sound system, the 128-bit sound, 128-bit or higher feeds sound just as good as what you're going to hear from an iPod if you're buying radio or music off of iTunes at 128-bit characters, or you're encoding your MP3s at 128 bits off CDs, you're going to hear a very, very high-quality sound coming from that. It's very useful. I find it interesting because it's commercial-free, so I don't have to listen to those long runs of commercials that commercial radio these days loves to put on. And you have a wide choice of different sounds to listen to. So for your post-tax season work, you can relax, pick up some radio stations, and just find a way to relax on the job. Now, this has been Tax Update for Saturday, April the 22nd, 2006. Tax Update is sponsored by Limeburg Information Services on the web at www.limeburgservices.com. Again, please confirm any of the items we discuss in this podcast before acting upon them. We will be back next week, hopefully, with more on this as we go in our post-tax season mode. This has been the Tax Update for Saturday, April the 22nd, 2006.